That's the record button. Have we started?
We have started.
So, this is the Meet for TeaCast. You might always start like that. Who knows?
Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Washington Irving.
And this is Julius Irving. Welcome to Season 5, Episode 3 of the Meet for TeaCast. I'm Mark Allen Miller.
I'm Elizabeth McDuffie. But we are in spooky season, and I was reminded of Washington Irving's fantastic tales for this season, for any season, but I think people think about this time of year when they think about the Headless Horseman.
You see, the reference
Ichabod
wasn't...
Ichabod Crane.
The reference wasn't immediately dawning on my marble skull, so I just went with another Irving. Anyway, welcome to the newest episode of the Meet for TeaCast, and we have a very special guest.
We have a returning guest.
Yeah.
Gail Brandeis was on in our first season.
Was that season one? Wow.
I believe so. And that was recorded in a hotel room where we were temporarily residing post-house fire a few years ago.
You all probably, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, probably we're following the tale of our 6 months during the pandemic.
And in that conversation, Gail and I talked about her fantastic book, which is a series of poems, Many Restless Concerns, and the subtitle is The Victims of Countess Bathory Speak in Chorus. Talk about, you know, if you're looking for something to read for a spooky season or any season, that's a good one too. It's from Black Lawrence Press. It's amazing. She just gives voice to Countess Bathory's victims. But this time, she's back and she has a brand new book, Drawing Breath, Essays on Writing, the Body, and Loss. And it's an absolutely stunning book. Maggie Smith says, Drawing Breath is both intimate and inventive, deeply personal and culturally relevant. This book, in a word, is breathtaking. I couldn't have put it better myself, so I didn't.
Yeah, it's a great conversation that Elizabeth has.
Great readings from the book.
Yeah, and goes lots of places.
Delightful to have my friend Gail back on the podcast.
If you're here now, then clearly you're in for a penny, in for a pound, and I'm telling you, you're going to get a pound for your penny on this one.
It's a lot of fun.
But before we talk into that, we should probably just get a little housekeeping out of the way really quickly.
Yeah, well, one thing I was disappointed to observe is that we don't have a new review to share with you guys. So, you know, insert sad trombone here. So, how's about you go over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review. Save your reviews with fewer stars for something else like the Joe Rogan podcast.
Good idea.
5 stars for us with writing. Write whatever you want. If we like it, and we usually do, we'll read it on the podcast. And you can keep your life really easy and streamlined by just copying and pasting that, popping on over Good Pods, paste it in with the same 5-star review. Good Pods has a lot of features similar to social media, similar to Goodreads too, that let you share the podcast you just listened to on your social media and let you recommend it to your friends. They really make that quick and easy.
And they're super indie friendly, and we love Good Pods.
We love Good Pods. They are very indie friendly. We're happy to be sitting currently at number 2 in the top 100 performing arts podcasts. We're usually number 1, and you know what gets us up there is your reviews. Mm-hmm. So there's your incentive. Keep us at number 1.
Very quickly, what are some other ways people can support us?
Well, all the best ways to support us can be found on our website, meetfortea.com, meatfortea.com. There you will find ways to subscribe to Meet for Tea, the Arts and Literary Journal. That's one of the very best ways to support us.
Yep.
To buy individual issues, whether in print or in PDF form. PDFs are only $5 a pop, so you could collect a bunch of Meet for Tea. You could collect all the ones we've published over the last... we've got the first
in the last 14 years.
14 years on the website. The first 3 years, if you find an issue from one of those years, know that you have in your hand a rarity. Mm-hmm. And treat it as such.
Not many of those out there in the wild anymore.
Not that many. We also have a Patreon. We're adding more things to our Patreon. There will be more stuff coming soon. And we have our merchandise in our spring store, where as we move into fall, we do have fantastic long sleeve t-shirts. We have mugs for your steaming hot cups of tea.
Hoodies.
We have hoodies. We have socks. We have all the essentials for keeping you cozy this autumn. And we are currently, this is the last day of the last sale we ran.
Just basically extending it for another month.
And but this time.
Now, the promo code for free shipping on anything ordered from Teespring is
MeatyWeen. Keep your dirty thoughts to yourselves. MeatyWeen.
Like the band Ween. Yeah.
Whoops, I broke.
Yeah, that's okay. Because this is the Meat for Tea cast and none of this is scripted. So
those are all the best ways to support us. I don't think I left anything out. You know, one of the best things you can do, and like I said before, Good Pods does make it easy to share this. Tell your friends and family about Meat for Tea.
Like and subscribe, as they say.
You can review individual episodes.
Yeah, that's a really cool thing about Good Pods. I don't think it's exclusive to Good Pods, but Good Pods does allow you to actually comment on individual episodes really easily.
And you can review the whole podcast.
Yep.
And you should do that. You should do both. We especially love when you leave us, email us a voice memo.
Yep.
With you reading your review so we can have your voice on the podcast.
Yep. It's great. We love that. So you can email those over to meatforteacast, M-E-A-T, meatforteacast @gmail.com.
So easy peasy.
I think that's good. We can talk right into this conversation.
I think we should talk right into it. It's really a lively and fun conversation. I'm honored to be friends with Gail Brandeis. She's brilliant and charming.
All right. Grab a snack, grab a beverage, settle in. We'll see you on the other side.
Have your tea and your meat for tea mug.
That's right. Here's Elizabeth and Gail.
Hello, Gail.
Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm well. It's so nice to talk to you.
You too. Such a treat.
Always a treat. So let me just formally invite you, announce you. It's my honor and privilege to have author Gail Brandeis back on the Meat for Tea cast for a second time. The first time we were talking about your book of poems, connected poems, Many Restless Concerns. Did I get the title?
Yes.
Yes.
You did.
And it's fantastic. And I've been very much enjoying reading Drawing Breath, essays on writing the body and loss. I am about halfway through it, which, given that I'm in a book club and have been reading submissions too.
I'm grateful that you've read any of it. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me back. The honor and privilege is all mine, truly.
It's really just been a treat to read.
Thank you.
And it's been just such a fun journey of discovery. We have so ridiculously much in common, including that petrichor is also one of my favorite scents.
Isn't it the best?
That's why I sent you that link, all the perfumes that are inspired by petrichor.
Yeah, thank you for that.
And I love that you quote Luca Turin. Do you have his book?
I don't. I found that quote online, and I would love to read more of it. I guess I read an excerpt of the book online, and it was very intriguing.
Yeah, it's he's a very, very funny guy. And it's, I'm looking at it now. Yeah, I have Perfume, the A to Z Guide by Luca Turin and his wife, I think it's Sonia Sanchez. Last name is always Sanchez. But the negative reviews in particular are just hilarious. And some of them are just a sentence or two long, and that's all you need. And it just like makes the most stabbing put down in a matter of a few words. It's just, he's wonderful.
That's an art, for sure.
It's really, really a fun read. It's so good.
Awesome.
Yeah. So Drawing Breath, I just love what you do with the language, just even drawing breath, and just finding out that breathing and breath and asthma were played a central role in your childhood.
Yes.
And mine as well.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when I started to think about how breath and punctuation are so intimately interconnected, it just made me think of what sort of sentences I was writing or I have written as an asthmatic. And yeah, I think the sentences get shorter when the breath gets shorter for me. And I had fun playing with punctuation in that piece to try to capture that sense of breathlessness.
Yeah, I love that. And just the whole chapter two, Drawing Breath, that's broken up into the inhale, exhale, inhale sections, and then your writing is shaped.
Yeah, and that
form writing.
The shape of the writing in that piece, I actually can't take credit for. The brilliant designer Jenny Kimura, who designed the book, the graphical parts of the book, she suggested that because it had been divided into inhales and exhales from the start. This is actually a piece I wrote over 20 years ago as my critical paper when I was getting my MFA.
Oh, wow.
And we had the freedom to really write about whatever we were most passionate about. And I was really curious about the connection between writing and the breath, and used this assignment as an opportunity to delve deeply into that. And it made sense from the start to divide it into inhales and exhales, where the inhales were looking inward at my own experience with breath, and the exhales were looking outward into research and various things that have been written about writing and the breath. And so that structure was there from the start, 20 plus years long ago. But then when Jenny Kimura started putting it on the page, she thought there was an opportunity to make the text look even more like breath. And so she created those beautiful shapes on the page that are convex and concave and really capture that sense of a rib cage.
Rib cage.
sort of contracting and expanding, you know, filling with breath and emptying. And I thought that was such a brilliant idea, and it looks so beautiful on the page.
I love it so much. And here I thought that was just you, just being
a
genius.
I wish I could take credit for that, but she took it to the next level, and I'm so grateful that she did.
Yeah, it's so interesting. When I was teaching college English classes and responding to student papers, I would tell them to think about in their sentences, where do you naturally pause to take a breath? And maybe that's where you want a comma.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that natural pause? And I know that's not how clauses work, but it often ends up working.
It totally ends up working. And, you know, when my son is working on schoolwork and he asks me to take a look at it to see if I have any feedback, which is very sweet that he comes to me with it, I'll look at a sentence and I'll ask him, where do you take a breath here? And he'll realize, oh yeah, comma goes there because I need to take a breath. And it's fun to share that experience with him. But yeah, I often will talk to my students about that and how a semicolon creates an even slightly deeper breath, and then a period. If you really want that sentence to hit and for readers to pause until they take the next breath, like put a period there, let that image sink in as the reader breathes, finishes that breath. And yeah, it's kind of wild how punctuation is kind of like musical composition in that it does control readers' breathing. And it's quite amazing that we, you know, we have such intimacy with readers through the mind and with ideas and stuff like that, but also that intimacy on a physical level where we can actually change how a reader breathes. And I think that it's quite amazing that punctuation can do that.
Yeah, I think so too. And especially if you're going to perform a piece out loud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then it becomes really like just set directions for oneself about where to breathe.
Definitely it does. Yeah, that whole thing was interesting to me. And then you also had a little bit of a body dysmorphia thing, which I also had as a girl.
Well, I'm sorry. I think a lot of us do. I think our culture inspires that in us.
I think so, sadly. Too. And I also think you're a little bit younger than me. I'll be 61 October 9th.
Okay.
And you're...
Oh, happy almost birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're not too far apart. I am 55.
Yeah. So I've had a theory for long years. I keep meaning to do some essaying about it. But I think women of our mother's generation and probably their mothers before them seem to feel it was kind of their maternal duty to instill in their daughters a sense of the needfulness of slenderness.
Sadly, yes.
You know, because it seems to be very generational.
Yeah, it does. And
right?
You know, my mom had been a model as a young woman and was so proud of her, was it 22 or 23 inch waist that she had as a young person? And, you know, which is so unrealistic, of course. And yeah, she would constantly ask me if I'd gained weight and make comments about my figure. And it definitely screwed up my relationship with my body, along with all of the cultural stuff we absorb, of course, too. It wasn't just her, but she played a large role for sure.
And the whole reflection on thighs and thunder thighs and my gestalt of you, especially doing, you know, moving and musing when I have the opportunity, is that you're quite fit and slender, enviably so. But that way of thinking about parts of your body as not being right, it's not necessarily rooted in anything rational at all. It just gets stuck in there.
It's completely irrational. And it still rises up in me, mm-hmm. even though I know better and even though I understand where it's coming from in terms of the internalized sexism and patriarchy and capitalism and all of that stuff that seeps in and tells us that we're not enough as we are, or that somehow we're not right if we look human. I think even, you know, I don't know if you've seen the Barbie movie.
I loved it.
I loved it too. And the fact that cellulite was thought of as this horrific thing within it, I wished that they had taken more time to actually unpack that and talk about how 90% of grown women have cellulite and that it's natural and it's not something that's like a grotesque horror show, that it's part of a human body. They could have done more with that, but I love that they brought it up, that it was something that we've been taught to fear, even though it's perfectly normal and natural. And I say these things, I know these things, I teach about loving the body and write about loving the body, and those voices rise up in me. It's part of my lizard monkey brain that I have to have conversations with sometimes and dance with and wrestle with and, yeah, get back to that place of loving and accepting my body as it is.
Yeah. Well, growing up with a model mom, and my mom also had a 23-inch waist. She's very proud in her wedding pictures.
Yeah, how is that even possible? That
you know, I did for a while, but after my first baby was born and I got my figure back. And also, what a weird turn of phrase is that?
Yes.
You make a whole entire human being and getting your figure back is somehow a project you're meant to undertake alongside of keeping this brand new human being that you made with your body. Like that's not enough. No, you get your figure back. And where did it go? It changed, but it's still a figure.
And I love that. I think things are changing for the younger generations where there's so much out there now about, of course, we still get these same messages too about getting your figure back after you have a baby. But I think
lose the baby weight.
Yeah. But I think that there's also the beautiful body positivity movement and body love. And I see even a former student of mine, a former undergrad student recently had her third baby, and she posted something about loving her body as it was and how, you know, she was encouraging other mothers to love their bodies as they are, these bodies that can care for our babies. And, you know, whether or not someone is nursing or just being able to snuggle with a soft belly. And it made me just so happy to see the younger generation kind of encouraging one another to not fall into that trap of feeling like they have to look like a movie star anytime, but especially right after giving birth.
Yeah, it's just so unrealistic. And your mom's thing was thighs. My mom's was knees. She's like, I hope you don't get your father's big knees, which I've puzzled over all my life. Like, what exactly are big knees? all I can think is that he as a young guy, was tall, 6 foot tall, lanky guy. So probably his knees were more prominent than a woman would want her legs to have, which wasn't my problem. And this is something she like saddled me with, and I was like three, and my knees were like dimpled and round and babyish looking.
My heart goes out to 3-year-old Elizabeth.
Well, you know, because that's how 3-year-olds are shaped generally. Little bit round.
Yeah, of course. And that's cute. Beautiful. And you shouldn't feel like anything's wrong with that. I think about my daughter, my beautiful daughter, and somehow these messages get in, even if not from the home, because it was really important for me to try to instill, just body love and acceptance in my kids. Mm-hmm. And, but I had bought her a leotard, I think, for a dance class that was coming up. And she tried it on and she said very excitedly, now I can lose weight. And I had never, uttered those words near her. I don't know where she had picked it up. She was probably around 6, so she must have heard something at school. And maybe she was even younger than that, at preschool. I can't remember the exact age, but the fact that somehow she had absorbed that and was and mirrored, like mimicked it, it was devastating to me because I had really tried to keep her safe from that kind of thinking. But it's just everywhere. We breathe it in.
It's atmospheric.
Yes.
Yeah, because I remember my youngest daughter, I forget how the conversation came up. She's like, Mommy, you never made me feel like I had to do anything about my body, but I still always kind of felt like I did. So it just gets absorbed somehow.
Yeah.
And yes, the book is called Drawing Breath, but I guess because breath is so truly universal, you've got space to explore so much.
Yeah, and breath is right where the body and mind meet, because it is a physical thing, but it also impacts our state of mind so much, which is why, you know, breathing is such a focus in meditation and yoga and things like that, where it's so connected to both. And I love that the breath is at this nexus. And I think writing is too, at that nexus between body and mind, that it contains both, that both contain it. And so breath is everything.
It really is. So when you're drafting, do you like to draft initially longhand?
I used to. And at some point I shifted away from that, and I can't pinpoint when that happened. I have so many notebooks full of first drafts. And at some point I started drafting on the computer. Every once in a while I do feel moved to handwrite a first draft. And my writing is so much sloppier than it used to be. Like, I used to have such beautiful handwriting, and it's so sloppy now. And my little writing bump on my middle finger has gone flaccid. It's like barely there anymore.
The pen holder.
Because I don't write with a pen as often as I once did. And that makes me a little bit sad. But it also does work for me to draft on the computer. I feel comfortable doing it. And every once in a while, especially at the start, the very start of a program, not a program, a project, I'll start jotting down things in a notebook until I kind of find my way, and then I'll transition to the computer.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking about the body-mind connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the words flowing from your brain down your arm. Onto the page.
Yeah, definitely there is a special connection there, because the way you're shaping each letter is very much your own when you write it by hand. And so there's that deeper intimacy and physicality that's, just so yours. So I feel like I want to get back to doing a little bit more of that. Maybe I can beef up my writing bump again.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't know from reading this that it wasn't drafted by hand.
A lot of these pieces were, the older ones.
Oh, interesting. Sure. Maybe that's where I got that feeling from.
It could be, yeah. Yeah, because it's really fairly recent that I shifted to drafting on the screen.
How long ago?
I can't pinpoint it exactly, but I would say within 10 years.
A move out of practicality.
Yeah. It's just more efficient.
Quicker.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think I even made the conscious choice to do it. I just kind of started doing it.
Yeah, I go back and forth. I do a lot of, I try to write a little bit every day in a journal. And now I'm doing a really cool workshop with Sivia Gover. I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's got a cool...
The name sounds familiar.
Yeah, she's collaborated with a lot of people. And her book, Dreaming on the Page, is pretty groundbreaking, about taking dream dictation and using that to get at poetry.
Oh, I love that.
I do too. And she recommends, obviously, keeping a notebook by your bed while you're doing it. But when I come out of REM sleep and a dream is still fresh in my mind, I'm too groggy to actually even physically hold a pen or shape words. So I use the notes function on my phone.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's one time where I'm really grateful for autofill. Because I can start to write the word and the phone will guess, and I'll be like, that one, and groggily make my way through recording these dream images.
Oh, that's so cool. I have never kept a dream journal, and I've always felt like I should. Like, I've known so many people in my life who've kept dream journals and find them so vital to their understanding of themselves and just their inner work. And I always think, oh, I should do that. And then sometimes I'll wake up and I'll tell Michael about my dreams, and then I forget them. And I think recording them would be so rich and truly, you know, such great material for poetry, such intense and surprising imagery. And definitely some of my poems have come from dreams, but I've never had a practice of writing my dreams down. And I think that would be really cool. I love that you did that.
Yeah. Well, I always did. And then she started offering the workshop, and I'm one of the lucky ones that can just do an ad barter. She does an ad and meet for tea. I get to do the workshop for free.
Lovely.
Well, that's my editor's budget for you. So, yeah, I like it. And the stuff that pops up is just so surprising and weird.
Mm-hmm.
So weird.
Yeah.
Stuff, I don't even know where it came from. There's those dreams where I must be younger because I'm still having my period. And there's like louche, dissipated alcoholic Frenchmen that I flirt with. And these characters that I know not whence they came, but there they are.
That's so cool.
Strange people parading through those dreams, I tell you what.
Most of the people in my dreams are fairly shadowy. And I feel like I remember places in my dreams more when I wake up than I remember the people in them. Or creatures, I remember a lot. I dream often of like sea creatures.
Like what sort of creatures?
Just ones that don't exist.
Oh, I love that. You can make up names for this whole menagerie.
I should do that.
How fun.
They show up a lot, but I don't know if I could describe any of them. The specifics kind of float away, but I can remember the way the water is teeming with them. And often it's a swimming pool just filled with sea creatures, but sometimes it's a natural body of water. And I often will have to decide whether or not I want to get in the water with them. And usually I'm scared to, but sometimes I will get in. And I remember actually when I was getting my MFA, I had a dream about one of these swimming pools filled with sea creatures. And my friend Lorraine Herring, who I graduated with.
I love her.
Isn't she amazing?
I've been lucky to publish her. She's actually had artwork on a Meet for Tea cover.
Oh, right. Yes, yes. I remember that. Beautiful.
I love her so much.
Yes. Well, me too. We've been close friends for over 20 years, and we, you know, are each other's first readers often, and we're working on planning a class together right now, actually. And I had a dream where I was really scared to dive into the water, and she dove straight into this pool full of sea creatures. And to me, it really spoke to just her bravery, and I was just in awe, and still am in such awe of her as a writer and person. And at our graduation, we got to choose someone to introduce us, or maybe it was for our graduate reading. And when I introduced her, I talked about that dream. And so I've been having dreams like that for a long time. They still pop up every once in a while.
I love that you guys are friends. I don't know how that escaped my notice. I wanted to do her memoir workshop, but I dream of doing it. The timing, I was just in the throes of reading submissions and getting this most recent issue of Meet for Tea together, and at the same time,
I totally get it.
Like just no time. At the same time, drumming up money so I could afford to print it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of these days,
she and I, just giving you a little sneak preview. Ooh. We're planning a 9-month memoir writing program together that will start next fall.
Oh, that's so exciting. I have to manifest a whole bunch of capital so that I can do that.
I'm super excited.
Tell me the title of it.
The working title is Imaginal Memoir Cave.
Yes. I love everything about that.
Yeah, we're super excited. We just had a meeting about it on Monday.
So wait, you guys live proximal to each other?
No, it was over Zoom.
Oh, But so you teach I'm in Chicago. Together.
She's online. We're going to do this. It'll be a virtual class, virtual program.
Oh my gosh. We'll talk about the nitty gritty when we're not podcasting, but I'm deeply intrigued. How wonderful.
It's going to be amazing.
I'm sure. I have absolutely no doubts. The title's amazing. It's like mythological.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And imaginal it comes from the cells that are inside caterpillars after they turn to goo inside their chrysalis. There's the imaginal cells inside that goo that tells the caterpillar what it's going to become. And so we're looking for those imaginal cells inside our work that, you know, are going to help shape it into what it's going to, into the butterfly it will become.
Trigger some metamorphosis.
Yes.
But not Kafka-esque ones, we hope.
No, none of those.
none of the Gregor Samsa for us.
No, unless that's what someone wants, of course.
Right. I love that. Yeah, you draw on science a lot in your writing.
I love science.
I do too. Well, the language, and I think a lot of people might think of science and poetry, and well, this book is essay, but it's still deeply poetic. I think a lot of people think of them as being perhaps antithetical to each other, but I think the language of science is very poetic.
I think so too. And I think that both poetry or any sort of, you know, meditative writing, lyrical writing, and science are or can both be about paying close attention to stuff. So I think about like scientists looking through a microscope and having to pay such close attention to these tiny things that we can't normally see, or just having the patience to watch something over time with an experiment or looking out to the stars. And it's really about paying attention and noticing connections and noticing patterns. And poetry is so much about that too. And I think it's there at their heart, they can both be about wonder and asking questions and just, yeah, noticing stuff. And I love science for that reason. And I love poetry for that reason. And I think the two can be so deeply intertwined. And we see it in, I feel like I'm going to get her name wrong, but Rosebud Ben-Omi, maybe. She writes a lot of very science-based poetry. I have an anthology somewhere on my shelves. I'm trying to find it now, that's full of poems that are about science or that are scientifically informed in some way.
Oh, how fantastic.
And yeah, I love it. I often, if someone asks if I wasn't a writer, what field I would choose, and I often think that I would want to be a research scientist of some sort because of that need to pay close attention. Perhaps someone, you know, out in the field, a botanist or something like that. But I love that practice of coming up with an idea and testing it and just using your senses to understand the world.
Yeah. And I think the best writers have to do that and pay very close attention.
Yes. Yes.
And even just sit with things for a while. Yeah, I love that. I want to go back to those watery dreams. So is that a recurring dream image for you? These swimming pools and other bodies of water?
Yeah, and they're not, they don't necessarily return to the same place, but it's just these various landscapes or various pools that show up in my dreams filled with strange folks, strange creaturely folks that are very mythological looking. It's unclear whether they're dangerous or not because they seem fairly peaceful. They're not gnashing teeth or anything like that. They're just kind of all swimming around. But it's a little scary and overwhelming to see them. but also like awesome. Sometimes just like images are floating back to me right now. Sometimes I'll be on some sort of scaffolding over the water and doing a sort of parkour in the scaffolding and just wondering if I'm going to fall into the water. Yeah, I think it feels clear that water teeming with sea creatures is the subconscious. It must be.
Yeah, the sea creatures seem like little thought forms.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I find myself scared of them. But I think sometimes it can be scary to dive into our own thoughts.
Yeah, no, I
the
love
weird,
that.
Weird things there.
I love that so much. I have, if I've got a recurring dream image, it's inhospitable houses that are difficult to access, where I have to climb in narrow and precarious places and squeeze through places and get up ladders that is strange, like M.C. Escher-esque.
Oh, wow. Like, interesting.
They appear a lot, and they're always like really, really difficult to access and really hard to exit. And then there's always a point in the dream which corresponds to real life where I'm frantically looking for where there might be a bathroom in this.
I have lots of bathroom dreams.
Everyone
too.
Does, I think. I think in our sleep, yeah. We just become aware.
Yeah. And often my bathroom dreams are like really disgusting public bathrooms.
I don't want to go there.
Yeah.
Is that all there is?
Yeah.
Is there anything better?
Yeah. They're heaped with poop or they're like the door is off or something.
Something's broken.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or sometimes there's just like a random bucket. I had one where there's just a baby's potty training toilet. No, the little potty chair. I was like, well, that's hardly going to work.
Yeah, I'm thinking, like suddenly again, I'm just being flooded with past dreams. And it feels like often in my public bathroom dreams, there are like mean girls there and I have to go to the bathroom in front of the mean girls and don't want to. It's wild what our subconscious will do.
Our brains
are so fascinating.
You can tell I don't come into these conversations with a plan. I read the book. I have some leaping off points, but then I just like to see where we...
I love that. I was not expecting to talk about bathroom dreams
Nor
tonight,
was I.
I'm so happy.
I like seeing where
just
things...
going anywhere.
Yep. Where it goes, where it unfolds. I absolutely love that. And I love that you do meditate on the language of perfumery a little bit and of joy.
Yeah, it was my mom's scent.
Yeah.
And so her. It's hard to think about her without thinking about that scent.
The world's most expensive fragrance. That was the ad copy.
Yeah, which would appeal to her because she wanted to be a wealthy woman and lived as if she was a wealthy woman, even though she was not. And so I think, yeah, joy was a status symbol, a status scent, that it was a way to sort of live her aspirational wealth. Yeah, so there was a lot to dig into with that.
Well, and also just the word joy, and given her life and everything.
Yeah.
Yes. That it goes a little oxymoronic. Super interesting. My mom's was Shalimar.
Oh, interesting.
So another glamorous lady who also wasn't wealthy but wanted to be and was very slim and very chic and very beautiful.
Yeah, my mom too. She turned heads up till the end, I think.
Yeah. There's a whole, maybe I will ask you to read a passage soon. There's a whole section where you, it's on page, are you taking requests, Gail? I'm making requests.
I'm happy to take requests, sure.
Yeah, it's on page 85. and you can lead up to it wherever, but I just love what you did with her tragic suicide and then what you did with your language around there. And you can lead into it if you want to. You can approach it. It's your writing. You approach it any damn way you please.
Thank you. Yeah, so this essay is called Role Model, and it was my exploration of my mom's history as a model, my own sort of disastrous history as a child model. Oh, an amazing thing, just side note.
Yes.
I recently had the opportunity to teach a class that I wasn't supposed to teach. I was asked to fill in last minute for an instructor who had extenuating circumstances and couldn't come teach this 1 week class through Story Studio Chicago, where I teach other classes through them and love them. And it was a little overwhelming to be asked, you know, with less than a week's notice to fill in for a week long class.
Wow.
That's a challenge. 10 amazing writers who, you know, had submitted 20 pages each. But I'm so glad I did. It was an amazing, amazing class. And one woman in the class actually had helped to design the Star Wars Play-Doh box that my sister was on when she was a child model that I talk about in this essay. And of all the things this woman could have written about, she happened to write about that. And I stumbled into this class, you know, just unexpectedly, and learned that this woman and my family had this interconnection in the 70s. It was just the most wild set of synchronicities coincidences. So anyway.
Digressions are encouraged here.
It has that story connected to it. So,
wow.
So this is, it blew my mind. I could
it's
barely believe it.
It's blowing my mind right now.
So this part, this is one of the first things I wrote about my mom's suicide, actually. And one of the first things I wrote where I wrote directly to her in an epistolary way, which ended up being part of my memoir. Actually, this part of this essay ended up in my memoir, The Art of Misdiagnosis.
Which I still need to read. So many books.
No pressure or obligation at all.
Oh, I like reading your books.
Thank you.
I like reading lots of books. That's the problem.
Me too. So I think maybe I'll just read these two paragraphs. I don't know how you knew how to hang yourself, Mom. How to wrap that random electrical cord around your neck in a way that would work. You didn't learn it in finishing school. They didn't teach girls how to finish themselves in that way. But the surveillance camera showed you walking upright, regal, into the small room in the parking garage where you ended your life, walking as if you had a stack of books on your head. Your death fucked me up, more than I let myself realize at the time. After you died, I tried to put all my focus on my new baby, on the joy he brought, but your death lived inside me, a constant companion I tried to ignore. Then Michael's mom died from a sudden heart attack less than 4 months later, and that fucked us both up, individually and as a couple. We didn't realize how much it had fucked us up because we kept it to ourselves, kept it hidden from ourselves. It got to the point where we could barely look at one another. We were both seething with so much unspoken, unacknowledged resentment. All we could do was see our own bitterness projected onto one another's face. I think I'll stop there. I'm so grateful that we got through that. I blew up our marriage around that time, which, as you know, this essay goes into. And thankfully, he was so patient and forgiving, and we found our way back to each other. And I'm so grateful. I just love him so much and feel such remorse about that time period of our lives. It's really a gift that we were able to reconnect and build an even stronger marriage from the wreckage of that time period.
Yeah. I mean, you both had been through so much trauma. that it's
it was a wild time.
Yeah, you would expect something. Well, thank you for sharing that. That's got to be like, is it hard to read these passages now?
It is. It is hard.
I feel mean asking you to read them, but I love.
No, don't feel mean. I'm happy to do it. I think it's good to remember where we've been and where I'd been, and it helps me appreciate where we are all the more.
Well, and even in the midst of all this really bleak stuff, you're doing the most clever and witty and even humorous things with your language.
Thank you.
You didn't learn it in finishing school. You didn't teach girls how to finish themselves in that way. I mean, that's funny.
I'm glad you see that, because
it totally is.
I tend to write about such painful stuff, but I think I'm such a silly person just in general that I love playing with language. I love having fun with words and not taking myself too seriously, even though, you know, I do write about serious stuff. And so I'm really glad that the humor comes through to you. I feel like at some point I'm just going to have to write a silly book, just like the silliest, lightest, goofiest book, just to channel that part of myself more fully. Because it sneaks in, it creeps in and bubbles up in my work. But I think maybe I need to give it more attention.
I would be totally down to see what happens with that. You end up with an early draft that's looking for a home. You can send it on over to Meet for Tea.
Thank you. That's so kind of you.
Oh, I like your writing.
And we'll be back in just a moment. And welcome back.
I just encouraged a student to send you work today, so I very much hope they will.
I hope so, too. I'm closed for submissions right now, but I'll be reopening in another couple of weeks. We just released an issue September 9th.
Yeah.
So
awesome.
Yeah.
Was that the casserole one?
Yeah.
I love that as a theme. So good.
Thank you. I'm glad you're not one of those people who gets... I've had so many people be like, well, I want to send you something, but I don't know what to do with the theme. I'm like, do whatever you want. Ignore it. Be silly. Approach it in some postmodern weird way.
Yeah, I wish I had just been able to find the time to write something for it, because there's a lot I could say about casseroles.
Do you know why I chose that theme? It's very prosaic, actually. I have a lot of submissions, older ones, not terribly old, but older. And most of them are all very good, but I just ran out of space in the issues of Meat for Tea. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of leftovers, and I wasn't going to insult people and, you know, theme it leftovers. So what's a creative thing that we do with our leftovers?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. I love that you made a casserole. That's incredible.
Yeah. And there's new stuff in there, too. But I wanted to be sure to pick up, you know, stragglers, because something has happened. And I don't really have a slush pile, or it's just a teeny tiny one. Almost everything that comes in is really, really good.
Yeah.
Like all of it. It's such a gift, but... Each issue is already about 145 pages, and I can't really go bigger, not in ship physical copies. I've got to keep them to 9 ounces or the postage will slay me. So, yeah, that's where the themes sometimes are just rooted not in anything fanciful at all, but just in utter need.
I love that. It's so creative. Just like a casserole.
Just like a casserole. You do what you do. Now, the issue of Meat for Tea that you had your artwork, your photograph in.
And I love that you asked to publish that, by the way.
I liked it. I'm just greedy. I just see things. I'm like a Raven. I'm like, what's that shiny thing? I want to add that.
Yeah, photography became a really important outlet for me during the early days of quarantine and stuff like that. And so to have one of my photos in Meet for Tea really meant a lot. It was really sweet of you to ask.
Oh, I loved it. You know, I'm just greedy. I see things I like. I'm like, I want to put those between the covers of my publication. In that same issue is an early, I don't know if you noticed, I started a new thing in there called nosings, which is the silly portmanteau word I made up for musings of a nose.
Oh, I don't remember seeing that. That's so awesome.
So there's been different perfumers or people who write in the fragrance field, people who think deeply about perfume, writing an essay in almost every single issue. Because these are really interesting people, perfumers, really rich brains.
Yeah, I'm always so inspired when I hear about people who can use their senses in such kind of exquisite, minute ways, like super tasters who are able to taste like such like minute elements of flavor, and people who smell for a living, who can detect so many layers of scent and be able to give language to that, which is so tricky with smell because, it's just hard to find language for a scent sometimes.
It's so good for your brain to try.
Yeah. And so that's super cool. I love that that's a feature.
Yeah. And in the copy you were in, the raw issue, the nosings essay was composed by Nicola Thomas, who lives in England. Is she in York? I think she's in New York, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. But she actually won a Jasmine Award for that piece, which in the UK is...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's the most coveted award for writing in the fragrance industry. It's like...
That's incredible.
It's huge. So, yeah, check it out. She used the space for evoking the smell of her not so long ago deceased father. So it's really poetic and poignant and moving. And shot through with aromas, because that's a cool thing. The aromas, you know, they do transport us through our memories.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, because, the place, and I'm sure you know this, just how the place where the brain processes scent is where memory lives, like where the brain processes memory. And... Yeah, it's wild how scent can evoke so much memory and just bring so much back.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. I mean, in a way, a perfumer is kind of building time machines.
I love that.
You know, because you can...
Yeah.
A whiff of... joy, which might not be your favorite thing to experience because it's shot through with all kinds of stuff, or a whiff of Shalimar, which I went through a long phase of not liking, and then I got over it, but there's a long period of time where I didn't. But just the things that fragrances evoke, and the language of all the perfumery, like petrichor.
Yeah.
The scent words, even the ingredients, you know, ambergris.
Yeah.
They're so poetic and beautiful.
They are so poetic. Have you read the book Perfume by Patrick Susskind?
Hell yeah. Love it. Did you see the movie?
No, I never saw the movie. I think I just wanted to keep my experience of the book intact, but I am curious about it.
It was well done. They didn't make a mockery of the novel.
That's good.
I was very relieved because I was very excited. No, I love that. Yeah. And one of my favorite words, actually, alembic. The ancient device that they used.
Yeah, that's a beautiful word.
Isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's just got so much. If I ever did a side publication, maybe if it just did the nosings all in a separate publication, I might just call that one alembic, but the name might be taken.
You could just have an issue by that name too if you wanted.
I could. It's not a bad idea. I wonder if I should have you read another passage. You choose.
Oh, gosh. Okay. What do I want to read?
Unless you'd like a request.
Well, is there something that you would like to hear? Otherwise, I'm happy to find a passage to read.
I think you should choose. I gave you a rough one.
All right. Here's one just randomly that I opened to. I'll read a couple of paragraphs from We Too. And it's written in the first person plural to write about women who write in the first person plural.
Nice.
Besides, we know the individual is a myth. We are made up of about 37 trillion cells. About 100 trillion microorganisms live on and in our bodies. The breath we inhale has been exhaled by other humans and animals and plants. We are what we eat, all that nourishment and toxicity. The dust that coats our windowsills, our bookshelves, is made up of so much dead skin, so much shed hair, all of us mingled together. We like to think of aspen groves, the way each tree may look separate, but as part of a collective organism tangled underground. We like to think of murmurations, flocks of birds swooping around as one, or maybe schools of fish swimming together to scare off predators. So I'll stop there, just a little taste.
I love that so much. I loved it when I read it.
Thank you.
And you used another one of my favorite words, because don't we all collect our favorite words, writers?
Oh, yeah.
Right? But murmuration.
I was guessing that that would be the one. I love that word so much, too. And I love the phenomenon.
Me too. What is cooler than a murmuration?
Oh my gosh. So cool.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite things.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, there's so our culture as that piece talks about, you know, we learn about the hero of the story and there's such a focus on the rugged individual in America and American history. But we're all so interconnected. And writing, of course, is solitary, but we're so informed by everything we've read and all the writers we've talked to. And so it feels like, even though writing is a solitary act, it can feel like a communal one, too, because we're all in it together and we're all informed by one another. And I loved being able to play with that in this piece and just play with interconnectivity and that idea of not just relying on the individual voice, but how we can be stronger together and transformative together.
Yeah. I'm thinking back to Bakhtin's heteroglossia. That whole notion, the many voices come together. And another favorite word, like interdiscursivity and intertextuality, because it isn't like the writing might be done seemingly solitary, but the writer is sitting with the voices of everything they've read that's in their mind. Yeah. And their recent experiences and their dreams. So they're really in a whole lot of company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. All the ghosts we carry with us.
And that we put onto the page. And then, you know, then when it gets into the reader's hand, and I think we've been kind of elucidating sort of a reader response thing when I'm telling you about the things that this conjured up for me and just finding out that we have so much in common, my goodness. Mothers with 23-inch waists who wore very expensive perfume and, you know, when the reader comes to the page, then they bring all of their voices and their history and the other books that they've read to carry over into that experience. And between the two, there's the we two of the reader and the author coming together.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. It's all about connection and interconnection.
It's so rich.
Yeah, so rich.
And why write if not to make that connection?
I am just taking the step beyond writing to, you know, when you get into publishing and having to try to promote the book, the whole idea of marketing myself is really uncomfortable to me.
Yeah.
But when I started reframing it as a search for connection, that helped me a lot. It's not about just me kind of shining a light on myself, but trying to see like who this work can reach, who can I talk, who can I be in conversation with. And so it becomes less like me and more like here's some stuff we can talk about and think about together.
Yeah. And it takes the whole ick off the word, because marketing, it takes that ick off, and it's like, no, it's just connecting. It's just finding like-minded souls.
Mm-hmm.
So I should probably wind us into my final phase. I don't think I was doing this when I had you on a few years ago, 3 years ago, when we were in our hotel room recording. But I have come to have a kind of standard way of wrapping up. And you'll notice I don't interview at all. I let the conversation unfold very organically.
Yeah, I love that.
I like it too. And it's like a journey of discovery. And of being open and just seeing where things take us and what connections rise up. Yeah, I like it too. But I do ask three questions of everyone at the end because they're fun. I think you'll think they're fun. So what are you reading nowadays?
What am I reading? I feel like I have several books that I'm dipping in and out of.
Join the club.
one that I'll be discussing with my students this weekend is last year's Best American Short Stories.
Oh, lovely.
It's super rich and wild. And so that's a recent read. And I guess I'm looking at it over again before our conversation on Sunday. I'm rereading, oh my goodness, what's it called? The Poetics of Space.
Ooh.
By, oh my gosh, how am I forgetting his
name? That's okay.
I quote him in my memoir. And it's another reread. Oh, Gaston Bachelard.
Nice. I need to read that.
It's so good. And I'm writing about architecture right now, and so I felt like I needed to reread Poetics of Space. So that's a reread. I had started reading The Wonderful Soil by Camille Dungy a while back, and I had to set it aside because of various reasons, just life got in the way and made it hard to keep going with the book, but I was always eager to get back to it, and so I'm getting back to that now, and I'm loving it, just really beautiful. I think the subtitle is The Story of a Black Mother's Garden.
Oh, wow.
And she does a beautiful job just writing about rewilding her garden, but also goes into natural and cultural history and explores race and the natural world, which she does so beautifully. I first became aware of her work with the anthology Black Nature, which came out quite a long time ago. And love her poetry. And so this memoir is just gorgeous. So those are some of the projects I'm juggling, books I'm reading. I have others too that are on my bedside table that I've been dipping into a little bit. There's another architecture one that, it's called When, I can't remember Saarinen, the architect Saarinen's first name, but it's When He Met His Match, his first name. And it's a book about his wife, Saarinen's wife, who was an architecture publicist, but it's also a memoir by the author and her own experience as a publicist for architects. So
wow. That's
been really interesting. And Erno. I can't remember his first name, but yeah. So dipping in and out of those as well as other various things.
You can always just email me the names and I'll put them in the show notes.
Okay.
We can totally do that.
That would be great.
So architecture, why architecture?
I am working toward a book that I hope will actually become a thing. I'm finding my way into this project that's about coming home to Chicago after decades, almost 40 years, and landing in a house of an architect who I hadn't heard of before. And in fact, the previous owners who lived here almost 40 years didn't know who the architect was.
Wow.
But I did some research, found the architect. He has a super amazing story. And so it'll be kind of a hybrid memoir, but also biography of him. But also we enlisted his son, who's a general contractor, to help us with some renovations. And he's never worked on one of his dad's houses before. And so it'll also be an exploration of that process.
Wow.
Yeah. So architecture's on the brain.
Yeah. Right now. Well, what an opportunity.
Yeah. And this guy, I could talk a long time, so I won't tell you about him other than, J. Marion Guttmeier really needs to get the due, the attention he deserves. And I hope I can help do that with my work.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, I'm excited for this thing to come to be.
Thank you.
How fantastic. What are you listening to these days?
What am I listening to? Not enough. I feel like I don't listen to music as often as I would like to. And I feel like when I do, it tends to be like my favorite stuff from the 80s, which I'm kind of just stuck in that rut.
No shame. No shame in that.
So I would say my two touchstones are the Talking Heads, and I'm super excited about Stop Making Sense.
Oh, me too.
Back to theaters. I can't wait. And in fact, I've been in touch with my best friend from high school who we used to go see Stop Making Sense on a regular basis when it was played every Friday night at the Fine Arts Theater. And so I'm hoping, I haven't seen her since I've moved back here, so I'm hoping we'll get to go together. So yeah, Talking Heads and Prince are like my, just ride or dies.
Those are some really good ones.
And then NPR is the other thing I guess I listen to most regularly.
I start every day with Up First. NPR is Up First, no shame in that. I listen to Pop Culture Happy Hour several times a week. What happened to Selected Shorts, speaking of NPR?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
I'm sad that there hasn't been a new one since like mid-June.
Yeah, well, hopefully it'll be back. Maybe they're just on a summer break.
I hope so, because I really love Selected Shorts. It's very near and dear to my heart.
Yeah. Another one I love is Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Me too.
And
so
Peter
much.
Sagal, The host actually lives in the town where I live, just north of Chicago, and we're going to see him speak at the Art Center next week.
I think because you live near WBEZ.
Yeah, that's my new local radio station, my new old local radio station.
I listen to a lot of stuff that comes out of there. Nerdette.
Mm-hmm.
You like that one too?
I love Nerdette.
I adore Nerdette. And there was a goofy one where they had Peter Sagal on too. They were collaborating with him, talking about pop culture, television, and movies.
Huh. Oh, I don't think I know that one.
I can, it's just an offshoot of Nerdette. I'll send it to you. But the Nerdette ladies, they like to rib him. he takes a lot of ribbing. Like to pick on him about being old. So it's good. Yeah. Yeah. WBEZ's got some good stuff.
They do.
Uh-huh. Totally. Well, I think that's very admirable listening.
I feel like it's pretty boring listening.
Talking
but
heads? How do you ever get bored of the talking
that's
heads?
That's true.
Prince?
Never. Yeah. Never get bored.
Such a
genius. But I just feel like I should spread my umbrella, but I'm pretty stuck.
Well, I discovered a new band. We're lucky enough to see them actually at a big outdoor show this Saturday. Orchestre Tout Puissant, Marcel Duchamp. They're from Switzerland, and they're absolutely amazing. So I'll send you some stuff.
Awesome. I love the name. That's great.
Yeah, they're wonderful. There's actually some stuff rhythmically that kind of sounds like early Talking Heads. I think it wouldn't be a leap for your ears.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I probably need a good infusion. When my older kids were teenagers, they introduced me to a lot of music that I loved, and I was really grateful to get a fresh infusion of music, but then I just ended up, going back to my old standbys.
My son does a thing. I'll send it to you. He also collects vinyl albums, and he makes what he calls mixtapes, but it's from tracks of his vinyl.
Oh, fun.
With different themes every week.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. It's called mayithowl.com. He calls it From the Mind of a Feral Child, which I like to think I was a better mom than that, but okay. Feral.
I think raising feral children is
maybe it's an art form.
Thing. Yeah,
maybe there's
you don't
that.
Want them to get too civilized.
It's cool stuff. What are you watching these days?
Ooh, we finally got around to Succession, so we're still in the first season of Succession.
Ooh, I need to get into that. I still haven't gotten around to it yet.
We had been resisting it, but both my sister and my daughter had been urging me to watch it, and it's really compelling. So I'm enjoying it. So that's sort of the new like slow binge. we're trickling our way through it. The thing that we binged with our 13-year-old recently, which was super fun, was Jury Duty.
Wasn't that great?
Oh my gosh!
It was
so much
so fun.
I only know about it because of NPR, actually. There was a segment about TV and what different hosts were watching on TV, and someone mentioned Jury Duty. And so we watched it with our 13-year-old just over the last week, and it was super fun.
Oh, so funny. Oh, God, what's that actor's name? James.
James Marsden.
Yeah. I love a traditionally handsome man who can lambast himself so thoroughly and look like he's so clearly enjoying it.
Yes. Oh, he was amazing. They all were amazing.
Oh, my God. No, we've been to that whole thing. I hope they do more.
I hope so, too.
And they tied it up in a pretty tidy bow. They gave it a pretty good denouement. But they could they could also spin off.
Yeah.
Easily, right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I loved that. So did your 13-year-old love it?
He did. He was a little uncomfortable with a couple of the scenes.
Oh, yeah. I can think of which scenes would have provoked that.
But he loved it in general. Just like overall, we all are sad that we're done watching it.
Yeah, I hope it comes back. Succession is HBO Max, is that right?
Yeah, it's on Hulu now.
We need to get Hulu back again. We do this thing where if we pick up one premium platform, we temporarily kill another.
So that makes sense.
Well, just bills, just so it's not crazy. But we need to get Hulu back because I need to catch up with The Bear.
Oh my gosh, The Bear is so good, and
the second season.
It had come out before. Oh my gosh, second season is so intense. I haven't seen it.
We've got to get our Hulu back.
Yeah, you must watch it. Just so brilliantly written and acted, and we had been told, you know, that we needed to watch it, but we didn't. It had been out for a while, the first season, before we moved here, but then we started watching it after we moved to the Chicago area, and it just felt like the perfect show to watch after moving back here.
Totally.
Even like the theme song is about moving home to Chicago.
Totally. It is custom made.
It was custom made. And so it just, yeah, has been the perfect coming home show. And yeah, the second season is stunning.
Yeah, we need to reinvigorate Hulu. We'll figure out what we're going to kill.
What We Do in the Shadows is on Hulu. We're sad that season's over. So good.
The new season is... I love that. Yeah. I adore What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah, the most recent season is amazing. They're all amazing.
That's season 5, right?
I think so.
Yeah. This is the one where we finally get to find out if Guillermo gets turned into a vampire.
Yes, yeah. You get to find out.
I need to watch that. No, I love it. Okay, we've got to bring Hulu back into the house. We're going to have to kill something, kill HBO Max for a while to clear the way for a Hulu bill.
You can do HBO through Hulu, but it is a little, it's extra.
Yeah. Look at us, pop culture, TV watching ladies. Nothing wrong. We're in a golden age, though, of television.
We are. There's so much good stuff out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tell myself it's you know, I'm learning about storytelling.
It is storytelling. It's really good storytelling. And a lot of the best that comes to the screen comes to the small screen.
Yes, I agree.
Well, because people don't want to put the money into funding a movie project that's not going to be, you know, a surefire $1 billion moneymaker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so many great adaptations out there. Like Station, did you watch Station 11?
Yes.
So beautiful.
So
another
beautiful.
Another Chicago show. I thought that was one of the most beautiful TV shows I've ever seen.
It's absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful. I should ask you while we wind down. God, now I'm like, ooh, I know what I want to watch. We've got to fire up the Hulu again. I should ask you where people can find you and follow you.
Sure.
On your social media, where they can get their hands on your books, like especially Drawing Breath, but all of them, Many Restless Concerns, Fruit Flesh.
My website, www.gailebrandeis.com, GAYLEBRANDEIS.com, has links to buying all of the books, both through the publisher and bookshop.
I love bookshops.
I think those are the sites I have. I decided not to link to Amazon on my site.
Good for you. I support that.
Thank you. It just, yeah.
He doesn't need another silly-shaped rocket.
No, he definitely doesn't.
No.
Yeah, so you can find links to my books and my social media there. It's pretty much just my name on all the platforms. I feel like I haven't been On social media as much as I usually have been, but Facebook and Instagram are the ones I'm on most. Kind of trying to wean myself away from Twitter / X because what's happening to that. Yeah.
Do you do Threads?
I haven't tried Threads yet. I should try Threads. I'm on Blue Sky now, but I haven't done much with it, and I don't visit it too often yet. But I think it's a pretty platform I enjoy when I open it on my phone, seeing the pretty clouds.
Oh, fun. I haven't tried Blue Sky yet, but I do have Threads, and I'm still active on X for, I don't know. I feel like the clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. For how long I will be active there, because silly. I mean, I did things too, though. I kind of curated a very safe writer's community for myself.
Nice.
Yeah, and now I'm like, I was so mad when the Musky one bought it, because I was like, I just carved out this space and I blocked everything that needed to be blocked, and I have this like lovely little artists and writers community there. So I'm hoping I can export everyone Pied Piper-like to Threads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll have to give Threads a try. I don't know why I haven't yet. It just felt overwhelming to me to try yet another new
thing. Well, I haven't tried Blue Sky. And I was invited to Mastodon, too, and I took a look at it, and I was like, uh-huh.
Yeah, same. I created an account at Mastodon, and I have not looked at it since because it felt overwhelming.
I was just like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this exactly.
Yeah, it confused me as well.
So. Yeah, well, I'm glad I wasn't the only one. I thought maybe it was just, you know, uniquely dumb in a certain capacity, but it just no. Didn't add up to me at all.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's very intuitive.
Not for my intuition. Well, this has been such a treat. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me again. I just am so grateful, and
such
it's just
delight.
A joy to hang out with you.
I think so, too. We'll have to do it IRL sometime.
That would be lovely.
Thanks so much again. What a
thank you.
Actual delight.
Total delight.
Have a wonderful rest of your night, Gail.
Thank you. You too, Elizabeth.
Terrific.
Wasn't that fun?
I always think it is.
I always think it is, too.
So, we're not going to linger on much longer right now, but we do have something coming up probably in about a week.
Something really special. Kristen Livermore, her new book with us from Meat for Tea Press, The Very Special Dead, just launched. She did a virtual launch party for today, its first publication day.
Today's October 1st when we're recording this, by the way.
That's right. Moderated by a brilliant author, Jacob Pauly. But we're going to be giving you a very special recording of that.
It'll be a bonus episode, probably out in about a week. And she's going to be on the East Coast.
Staying at our house.
Yep. In the middle of October, we will be announcing the reading dates over here on the Meat for Tea web. Well,
I can tell you what they are right now. There's one at Emily Williston Library on October 18th. That's a Wednesday night. I believe that's at 6:00. If I'm wrong, we'll correct it in the show notes. And then there is another on October 20th at Splendor Solace Bookstore on Market Street in Northampton, and that's at 5 p.m.
Yep. We should also have them on the events page on the meatfortea.com website, and also be announcing them in some way, shape, or form on the Meat for Tea Facebook page,
too. Yeah. And on the 21st, I'll be moderating a talk she gives in Connecticut. We'll put the details for that in the show notes.
So if you're proximal to this area for one of those dates, we highly encourage you to come out. Check it out.
If you like to do some foliage peeping, take a nice long drive. People like to do that this time of year. We offer that opportunity to get in your car and head on out here. Catch Kristen Livermore reading. Get a signed copy of her books. Ask her some questions.
Yeah, good times for everyone. Really good. Well, excellent. I think that does it for this episode of the Meat for Decast. And we will see you in a couple weeks.
Look forward to reading your reviews.
Thank you very much.
The Meat for Tea cast is produced by Elizabeth McDuffie and Meat for Tea The Valley Review. Visit Meat for Tea at www.meatfortea.com. Please consider going to anchor.fm to make a contribution through our contribution page. You can reach us through meatforteacast@gmail.com, or you can leave a voice message at anchor.fm/meatforteacast. We welcome suggestions for contents for the Meat for Tea cast. If you've attended a Meat for Tea circ and want to hear from one of the bands or one of the spoken word contributors, please let us know. All portions are copyright Meat for Tea and their respective holders. Vote for Meat for Tea on your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter at Elizabeef, Meat for Tea on Instagram, and on the Meat for Tea and Meat for Tea cast Facebook pages. Meat for Tea is available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts.